Well, given yesterday's weather, the Summit County Council called off its field trip to look at areas of concern as the council considers one of the chapters of the Eastside Planning Code. In the studio with an update of yesterday's council meeting is newly seated council member Glenn Wright. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So no surprise that the council didn't go on the field trip, but I'm guessing it'll be rescheduled when?
We don't know yet. I'm sure it'll be fairly soon.
So does this delay the decision then in terms of getting that East County Code in place?
It delays a decision on Chapter 2, which had to do with the ridgeline issues. I haven't seen the agenda for next week yet, but the preliminary information was that we were going to discuss Chapters 3 and 4 next week.
All right. There's been a lot of review already into this Eastside Planning Code. Given that you're new, are you caught up and ready to participate in this discussion?
I've been reading through the code, and I think I'm ready to participate.
All right. How did the council decide about the requested tax exemptions and David Luber's appeal of the rollback tax?
Most of the tax exemptions were fairly routine. There was a couple of nonprofits, Camp Oakley and Park City Tots, that were, nonprofits and fairly routine. Then there's a whole list of primary and non-primary residences that were not under dispute from the landowners. The Luber one... It's very good that we have experienced council members there. I would not have known to ask the appropriate question of Dave Thomas, but effectively we were prohibited by law from granting that tax exemption.
How come?
Because the appeal was not filed in a timely manner. And actually there was about 3 years of negligence on the part of the landowner in not filling out requested forms from the assessor's office. The landowner sold portion of the property a few years ago, I think it was in 2013, and then had to re-execute the documents that would have gotten the Greenbelt exemption, never followed up on it, never got the paperwork in after being reminded by the assessor's office every year. So there was very little we could do on that particular appeal.
So he's paying for it, literally.
He is paying for it. He says he's going to, execute the paperwork now and probably reestablish the Greenbelt exception going forward.
All right. So he will have the opportunity.
He does have the opportunity to reestablish it.
All right.
But his negligence cost him a significant amount of money in tax collections.
Yeah, that'll teach you. Let's see. For the community development block grants, did you recommend funding for Scott Loomis's $50,000 for a study?
We did. And that was already approved by the Wasatch County Council. So we were jumping in with that to give a little more emphasis to the request.
And what's the study supposed to do?
Study is supposed to do a comprehensive study of the need for affordable housing in both Summit and Wasatch County.
Okay. And when do you expect to have some results?
Well, first it has to go through the our approval of it is not money in the bank. This puts it into the CDGB process, and that probably will not get resolved for 3 to 4 months.
All right. So as we kick off the new year, what are you hoping to see accomplished this year?
Well, we can go back to some of the things I talked about in the campaign, and that's renewable energy, affordable housing, transportation improvements, and economic diversity. We have a meeting on affordable housing next Tuesday, so we're proceeding on those issues. I think from the discussions we've had so far, you're going to see some very significant initiatives in the affordable housing area. I also did a little private research on renewable energy and got some pretty interesting information from solar installers on the possibilities of commercial solar on the east side of the county.
You mean commercial solar for businesses? Is that what you're talking about?
Actually, commercial solar farms. There's lots of land over there. One of the solar installers told me that conservatively, an acre of farmland on the inside, on the east side, could generate over 300,000 kilowatt hours of electricity. So that could be significant.
A year?
A year, mm-hmm. Yeah. That could be a fairly significant income opportunity for some of our landowners if we could work out the details on how to make that happen.
Yeah, so as you're looking at the code, I'm guessing that's going to something that would have to
that
be
addressed.
That
isn't a code. I read through Chapter 3, actually, a few weeks ago, And there's already provision in the code for wind farms, but not for solar farms. So it would be pretty easy to take the paragraph that talks about wind farms and change wind farm to solar.
Or add.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Add a paragraph, not instead of.
Summit County, of course, will be represented at today's press briefing on the proposed purchase of Bonanza Flat. Is the council offering just moral support here, or are you actually talking about providing some financing or other commitment to help?
We are talking to the city about what we can do there. We don't have the flexibility the city has because the city's bond specifically talked about Bonanza Flats. The open space money we have available was specifically for Summit County, and the land is in Wasatch County. So we think there are some possible things we can do, but we have to talk to the city and see how they're willing to work with us and free up some money for that, to be determined. The city has a number of months now to actually put together the entire package, and we're certainly sympathetic. We think it's a good project because any development there would really affect Summit County citizens through traffic, increases sheriff's deputy involvement. Park City Fire District would be the first responder there. The sewer district would have to provide sewers. So it would affect the entire county if there's development up there, even though it's in close proximity to Park City.
Mm. So does it get annexed?
You'll have to ask the city that.
Okay. So, again, at this point, you're just offering moral support.
Moral support, but, we may be able to provide some financial. It depends how we can work with the city on some issues. We're talking about it.
All right, Glenn, thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome.
Better go get that parking spot. It's 8:20. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met on Tuesday night. On the phone with a recap, I have Commissioner Colin DeFord. Good morning, Colin.
Hey, Leslie. How's it going?
Doing great. Thanks. So your take on the Discovery Project, it did get a vote from the Planning Commission and was approved, or at least a positive recommendation, 4-1 vote.
That's right. We're down one commissioner right now, and B. Peck was out of town, so... And Greg Lawson was the one no vote. The meeting went really well. I was very surprised with the public input. I mean, hands out to the public for coming out. Most of our public comment was on the affordable housing project of Discovery. And as a commissioner, I'm particularly excited about the integration that the commission required for the project of affordable housing.
Yeah. On Tuesday night, you had mentioned that years ago, at first, there was no way you were going to approve this. So how did we get you to a yes vote?
There's been a tremendous amount of progress on Discovery, from the engineering to safety to the roads. The project has completely changed. It's a 180 from, I believe, when we first saw it. And I really thank the planning department, Amir Kaz and Peter Barnes, for what they did to make this project something that's actually safer, and a really good, walkable, and usable neighborhood.
I believe you said you were comfortable with the project, but you really haven't arrived to the really like stage. What would it take to get you there?
Well, the location, that's my issue with this project. I think it's great as far as integrating affordable and market rate housing. I think that's a great concept, and the council, hopefully, their eyes are wide open now to see the public support that the county has for a project like this. It's just the location. I think it's an awful location for a project like this.
Yeah. What's the applicant doing, or is the applicant doing enough, I should say, to save the trees there? You had heard from a couple of activists saying that you'd like to see some trees saved.
We went round and round. All of our meetings that the Planning Commission has had with the developer, we continually ask about the trees, so that this isn't the first time it was brought up, but they have a tree survey. They've identified where all the trees are over a certain circumference, and in a lot of instances it's just not going to be possible to save everything because of the grading that's being done for roads. And then these are small lot market rate homes, some are just 10,000 square foot lots, so it's probably not probable to save a majority of the trees, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Let's see. The Knob Hill Roadhouse, it sounds like the Planning Commission felt like they had to choose between two evils. That is a house on top of a ridge with an obstructive berm in front of it, or a house lower down the hill but a road scar leading up to. So which way did you lean?
You nailed it, Leslie. I mean, that's exactly what happened. So I actually am leaning towards breaking the ridge line. But, you know, when you look at it, there's already at least three, if not four, houses that break the ridge line up there already. So to me, it seems like a less of an impact to put another house that's going to minimally break the ridge line as opposed to scarring the whole side of that mountain with a driveway.
Okay, and has that come back to, or was that the recommendation that was made?
You know, so it was a work session, so we were talking with the applicant and talking with staff and giving our opinion on what we'd like to see done. So it'll come back to the Planning Commission at a later date with some more details and drawings on how they could possibly do the work to hide the house up on the ridgeline, possibly through landscaping or herbing.
Okay, and I guess there's also some height limits as well.
Yeah, and they're meeting all of that. So, I mean, the applicant and the architect are working very well with the county staff, so, and had some really creative ideas on how to position the house up there and also to mask it. So I'm looking forward to see what they come back with.
All right. Continued discussion on the amended Canyons Master Plan. Do you feel like you're getting your arms around this?
I think so. I'm pretty impressed with the developers over there and Replay, who's working hard on making the resort something a little bit more special. So we've been concentrating as a planning commission on understanding exactly what are the problems they're trying to solve. So that is really what we're looking for as a planning commission, is we want more information on why do you need more density over here? Why are you moving it over here? What did it look like before? And then specifically, we want to make sure that the height, if there's any changes in heights, that those are spelled out and shown, because, you know, if I were a property owner over there, I definitely want to know what was changing across the street from me and have that spelled out and easy to see and easy to understand. So that's where we're really going with it.
Yeah. Well, Replay and TCFC representatives say the changes are to make the resort a more pedestrian experience and keeping people from getting into a car. That's not realistic, though, is it? I mean, people are still going to go out to Whole Foods and to the movie theater and to the bowling alley and...
I think what they're trying to say is, you know, once you enter the canyons, as a commission in the county and as Replay and TFTF, we want you to park once. So even if you have to go to the canyons, you park once, but then you can get around the canyons. You don't have to go in your car to move to another location. That they're really trying to beef up the retail and the restaurant experience, so that once you're on like canyons property, that you're there and you're not moving around.
And your take on that, is that realistic?
Well, you haven't seen everything from them, and that's another one of the issues we've been hammering with them, is we really want to see how are people moving, how are people walking, how are you solving problems with the elevation, because that's a hard part when you have to move people from a lower elevation to an upper elevation. That's when people want to drive. So how are you making it easy for people to move through the canyons? And they're coming up with some great ideas and coming up with some attractive ways to capture and keep people in the resort core, which I'm looking forward to seeing more.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention, Colin?
No, I just wanted to, again, on the Discovery project, I just want to hit it home, though, that what we heard on that project is affordable housing. I know you had Glenn on just before me, and he was speaking about affordable housing, but wow, did we get... The majority of our public comment was on affordable housing. So it's there, and definitely we need to work hard on this.
All right. Colin DeFord, a member of the Snyderville Planning Commission, thanks for your time.
Thanks much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:29. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Planning Commission met last night to discuss traffic and Treasure Hill, among other issues like rezoning Rossie Hill. In the studio with me, I have Planning Commissioner Adam Strong. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Treasure Hill first, you know, this. What we're hearing is that build out of this project would take some 10 years, and it's already been some 30 years. So when we're looking at traffic studies from 12 and, you know, gosh, 2009, I mean, isn't the information going to change as Park City changes?
Yeah, and I think both the applicant and staff understand that. And fortunately, we have very qualified people in the city, like our city engineer, Matt Castle, and our transportation director, Alfred Knotts, who are meeting with the applicant. They met on Monday and asked the applicant to provide a number of updates to some of the information that had previously been submitted and is outdated. So we are at this point going to let the applicant decide whether they want to fulfill the city engineer and Alfred Knotts' requests. I encourage, and I think the commission agrees, that they should, because without that information, you're right, Leslie, it's some outdated info, and I'm not sure we can make a decision based on traffic studies from 2004 or 2009.
Yeah, so none of the studies also included the impact of traffic from the construction itself. So how does the commission feel about that?
Well, I think there were some comments last night about that, and you know, it needs to take that into account. The studies have to account for that. And, you know, as Commissioner Joyce pointed out, the studies should also take into account the commercial space. There's a great deal of commercial space on the project. And the traffic studies either fail to take that into account or understate it, according to Commissioner Joyce. And, you know, that's something that has to be looked at very carefully because, as he said, you know, we have places like the Montage or St. Regis, which they advertise actively to get people to come to their spa or come to their restaurant or what have you. And if Treasure does the same thing, that's going to have traffic impact. So we need to look at those.
You told planner Francisco Astorga to tread lightly moving forward. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think traffic is a very delicate issue, and I think the applicant's representative, Sean Farron, said it well. Everybody does think they're an expert on traffic because, you know, we all drive cars and we all sit in traffic and we all hate it, and we all think there's a better way to do it. And so I think that what the city has to be careful of is not implying its problems onto Treasure, you know. The fact that the intersection of Deer Valley Drive and Bonanza is backed up to the traffic circle is not Treasure's fault. And we have to be careful that we don't allocate impacts to Treasure that are either pre-existing or not attributable to the project itself.
All right. The applicant's attorney did a little housekeeping, as he put it, before he gave his presentation, saying that the conditional use permit is loaded with mountains of information that the public and the commission are taking out of context. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, some of that is lawyer talk and sounds maybe a little bit more adversarial than it's really intended to be. The applicant has submitted position papers prior to every meeting, and the commissioners have read those. And, you know, we understand the context of the MPD. We've all read it several times. The applicant is free to allege that things are taken out of context, but we read the MPD, we read staff's conclusions, and we decide for ourselves whether, you know, the MPD says what the applicant says it does, or whether it's staff's interpretation that's correct.
Yeah, he contends that the approval from 1985 and 86 used terms like building envelopes that established height only. He says in last month's meeting, the staff and commission allowed that term to kind of morph construction boundaries and limits of disturbance. Is that how you remember it, or are we talking about the same thing?
Yeah, and I think some background maybe is a little bit in order. You know, the question is whether this sheet 22 that's attached to the MPD has a boundary line on it outside of which no construction at all is permitted. And the applicant disputes that and says that boundary line only applies to the areas where the buildings can be built above the height allowed in the zone. So he says it doesn't have anything to do with whether there can be construction inside or outside of that line. Nicole Forge, who is the attorney for Think, got up and made what I think is a persuasive argument that it doesn't matter whether you call it a limit of disturbance line or a boundary line or whatever. That line marks the boundary between where the recreational open space zone starts. And in the ROS zone, there can be no permanent structures. And the retaining walls that the applicant is proposing are permanent indeed. So she contends that, you know, it doesn't matter what you call the line, it's the ROS zone marker, and if you build inside that, it better not be permanent.
All right. The applicant says that they're keeping track of all of the questions from the Planning Commission and the public and plan to answer them all.
I'm sure that's true.
At what point?
Well, you know, that's up to the applicant. You know, the applicant has control over that, and it's in the applicant's interest to do that. You know, I mean, unanswered questions are going to be strikes against the applicant, so I bet they do.
All right. And then there was, you heard from the public just regarding Lowell, how narrow it is. Commissioner Phillips asking if there was perhaps any way to dig a tunnel from another site that could lead to the project. Is that even feasible?
Well, I don't know. We haven't seen any plans in that regard. You know, I think there's precedent for tunnels in the past. There's a couple on the hillside there. And in Europe, they have them. I don't know whether the applicant will entertain that or not. I think really the focal point of the discussion, though, is, and it was raised in public comment, is the narrowness and the adequacy of Lowell and Empire. And right now on a snow year like we're having, that's a one-lane street, and not only is that difficult for construction traffic to navigate, but once the project's built, just the users, daily users, are going to have trouble. So that's something the applicant's going to have to answer.
All right. And then finally, I just wanted to note that the next Treasure meeting is scheduled for February 8th, but we're not sure whether that'll be held. Just we've got a lot of information to get together? Yeah.
As I said, the city engineer and the transportation director has asked the applicant for a number of things, and it's unclear whether the applicant's going to be able to provide those by February 8th. I would, as members of the public have in the past, keep continuing to monitor the website and the agenda and the packets that are distributed and make sure that we have a meeting or we don't.
Okay, and on to Rossi Hill. Planning Commission made a positive recommendation to change the zoning there from historic medium, I think it's RDM, residential medium density, to historic residential low density.
Right.
And then talking about a pocket park. So what's the difference between a pocket park and the open space there?
Well, I mean, I think that was maybe something that came up that wasn't entirely within the discussion outlined in the materials. And, you know, the question was whether we needed to rezone that area so that we could keep the transition in from the historic homes that are there to some of the larger homes that are very nearby. And I understand that that transition is a subtle one and very difficult for people to immediately see as they cruise up Deer Valley Drive and they see three small miners' cabins next to an 8,000-square-foot multiplex. But the city is doing what it can to keep the historic fabric as good as it can. And this zoning change, which was supported wholeheartedly by both the neighbors and the applicant themselves, the affected property owner, was approved.
Yeah. So how does this affect the historic homes on Rossi Hill, going from medium density to low density? I mean, how big can the homes be and how dense?
Well, it's the homes, I think the numbers were under the old zoning, they could have had 22 units, and now they can only have 8. I may be a little off on those, but it's close. That's a significant decrease in density, and I think Planning Director Erickson is right. You know, when you are talking about that part of town, every car and every pillow that's added makes a difference because it is just a dense little part of town with some interesting historic homes, and so you have to be particularly careful there.
Well, when you look on the one furthest east, going up Deer Valley Drive, it is like right next door to this humongous condo. So is that what we should expect to see, that condo then kind of translate into those?
I hope not. I always look at that and gag. It's just, I ride my bike up there every day almost, and it's the paradigm of incompatibility in the city. It's the thing I point to that I say, boy, we got that just dead wrong. And I hope not. And, you know, I guess the saving grace will be that these structures will be subject to the historic district guidelines. And I hope the HPB does a good job and is strict with those.
All right. The landowner, though, is supportive of the down zone.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's a landowner that's been there for quite some time, and I think they understand what's at stake. So they were supportive.
Okay. Anything else, Adam?
I don't think so.
All right. Hey, thanks for your time. Well, as much as city officials would have loved to announce the deal they were working on with the owner of the 1,400-acre Bonanza Flat open space, it was necessary for them to keep mum in order for the deal to be sealed. Although KPCW did attempt to get a comment from a city official about the news that was released yesterday afternoon about the city council and the option to purchase Bonanza Flat today for $38 million, they were unwilling to comment then. Later, Mayor Jack Thomas called, leaving a message saying that he would have loved to have talked, but couldn't.
I just wanted to touch base and let you know I would have loved to have talked to you earlier about this, but we've been in the midst of negotiations really down to the last moment.
Under new business, the council today is scheduled to take a vote on the consideration of an option agreement with Redis LLC for the purchase of approximately 1,400 acres in Bonanza Flat for open space for $38 million. Thomas says the council's approval is hinged on how much support they can get from other agencies to help pay for the $13 million difference between what residents bonded for and what this is going to cost.
Obviously, we're going to depend greatly on our partners in our community and adjacent counties to have support, and we think we have it. We think we'll be able to weigh into that difference between the $25 million that we have approved the GL bond for and the price that we had to compete for, the $38 million. So we'll talk more about that.
It's Park City Mayor Jack Thomas. He added that the council will be happy to answer questions at today's press briefing. That happens at 2 o'clock today outside of the Thatcher. Well, the Park City School District has hired Danny Fisher to serve as the district's new CTE specialist. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been in the Park City School District for 6 years now. Prior to that, I worked in private industry in several different roles, and I decided that the impact I could make on the community and world around me was much better served in education than it was in private industry. And since I've made the change, I've never been happier in my job.
Okay, well, great. So why did you want this job?
I've wanted this job for quite a while, actually. When we first started creating the CAPS program, I was one of the founding teachers with that. So I got to work heavily with Charlie Matthews and Jennifer Jackenthal to help build the program. Since then, I took on some additional roles at work that pulled me away from PC CAPS, but I've really had a longing to get back to that model of education because I truly feel that is the future of education.
So this is a completely new position. I mean, we had Jennifer, of course, serving kind of as the director of PC CAPS, but what, we're rolling all of that under one umbrella now?
Yes and no. Having both the PC CAPS position and the CTE position in one position is new. We've had a CTE director slash specialist in the past, and then when we moved to the CAPS model, they did away with that position and did the CAPS director. And so really we're coming back to taking those two pieces that we had before and putting them together because there's a need for both in the district.
So what's the difference between CTE and CAPS?
That's a good question. So CTE is our traditional classroom courses in the career and technical fields. PC CAPS is, if you will, a capstone. That's the play on words with PC CAPS. A capstone experience for students where they can take the culmination of their learning throughout CTE and their other classes and be able to apply it to these real world projects.
So is the CTE then, I mean, is it fair to say kind of a 9th, 10th grade, and then the CAPS is an 11th, 12th grade? Upper division or something, if you would?
I think that we can say that CAPS is upper division. It's not restricted to that. I would say that they're really two in the same. CTE and the courses that are offered there are really a pathway or an avenue for students to gain the experience and the knowledge to help them be as successful as possible in CAPS.
Yeah. So what are your marching orders?
My marching orders are to make an amazing experience for all of our students. With more detail, it's to help grow both the programs, both CTE and the CAPS program, and to better align what's happening in the classroom in our CTE courses with the experiences that students are having at CAPS.
So we've seen the CAP numbers drop off. There was initial, excitement for mm-hmm. it. So what is it that you need to do to make that more appealing?
I think communication is a big piece. I think that originally with Jennifer Jackenthal in the position, she did an amazing job of advertising the program and getting it off the ground and getting people excited about it. Since she transitioned out of that role and we've had others, we haven't had somebody that's truly dedicated to PC CAPS. And I think it's true in any field. If somebody's not dedicated to a job, it's not going to get the attention that it needs and you're not going to get the results that you're hoping for. So my goal is to strengthen that pathway from CT into the CAPS program. And I think that alone will ignite and excite kids to get back into CAPS.
All right. So in terms of the CTE program, I mean, do you need to start offering different kinds of courses to create that growth?
I think we always do. We need to be meeting students' needs and students' interests, and those are changing year to year. And so I think that's something that we'll always be looking at is our course offerings and making sure that they're meeting our current students' wants and needs.
Okay.
And not just the students, but the community as a whole. We have other stakeholders we need to keep involved in that conversation.
And so what are kids interested in today?
Well, currently, based off of the courses we're offering, software development and engineering have been two of the programs that have had the most growth over the last few years. The business and health science strands have had solid numbers and respectable growth throughout the years as well. So as we see these and we identify these needs, we look to offer more classes that students are interested in. CTE classes are elective classes, and typically the way electives work is if we have enough students interested, we run the class. If we don't have enough students interested, the class may not be offered that year, but could be offered in future years. So that student interest really drives what CTE classes are being offered at the time.
Yeah. So like with the health services, I mean, there was some like partnerships and with like the local hospital. Is that what we're seeing through that?
Mm-hmm.
EMT training?
Yep. And I actually hope that it won't be happening right away because being new to this position and there's a need for kind of stepping back before we move forward to make sure that we have the right things in place to be successful. But that health sciences area is an area that I would like to offer throughout CAPS as well.
Yeah. Gone away, though, is kind of like the auto mechanics class or that's offered, I know, in Wasatch County.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have students who are being bused from the high school down to the UVU campus in Wasatch for that program. So as we see increased need and increased want for that, we have the ability to still offer those classes to those students.
And then what about the whole hospitality and service industry? What are we doing there?
We actually put a new course offering in this year for a hospitality management course. So we're hoping that we get enough students interested in that we'll run that next year. It's always kind of been on the tips of our tongues and something we've wanted to offer. But throughout the last few years, we've had so many different offerings within CTE that we had to look at what we offered and make sure that they were in a viable pathway that was leading to career or certification. So that's one of the tasks that I have is to make sure that we're not offering one-off classes, but that they're part of a larger plan to get students into the careers that they want to or the college programs that they want to be in.
Okay. And then what about coding? Does that fall under the kind of the software and in computer engineering development?
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the district has been making strides. We have computer coding. Our students are being exposed to that from first grade all the way up till seventh. And so the onus is really on us at the high school to be prepared to take on the number of students who are going to want to have that. Kelly Henderson is one of our newer teachers at the school, and she's been pushing a lot with this. She's had a lot of growth in the number of students wanting her class. And most impressively to me is that she's actively out there trying to get more females into this field.
And then when, as we look at kind of the high school expansion options, what are we looking at? Currently, we've got CAPS now and moving from an off-site location now to taking over space in the high school library. Are we talking about kind of a wing for CTE CAPS in the new expansion?
I believe that is the current model. We have four different options that we're looking at. Within all of those options, we're looking to provide more and better space both for CAPS and the CTE program.
Okay. And in terms of when you roll out the courses for next school year, when does that happen?
That'll be happening in the next few months. Registration, I believe, begins at the end of February and ends at the beginning of March. We've already put in new course proposals that'll be in there. So students that haven't looked at our course offerings should look at them again to see some of these new course offerings that we're going to be providing.
Okay. Danny, thanks for coming in. Good luck.
Thank you very much, Leslie.
Danny Fisher, again, the new CTE and PC CAP specialist at Park City School District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
Hi.
Well, throughout 2017, Olympic qualifying events are being held leading up to the 2018 Olympics in South Korea. In the studio to talk about the legacy of our Winter Games and some of the results we're seeing now, I have Amy Preston, director of the Youth Sports Alliance, Hatch Haslock with Team Park City United, and Sam Masuga, a member of the U.S. Women's Ski Jumping Development Team. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Amy, real quick, maybe you can talk. What is, do you think, Park City's legacy from the 2002 Games?
Well, after the Games were held here, we had all these facilities that we were able to utilize, and all these little clubs popped up. So the umbrella organization of the Youth Sports Alliance came along, and we were able to do three things. We have development programs in Get Out and Play and our newly formed Activate in the middle school. So from grades 1 through 7, we're now doing all these introductory programs to winter sports. And then we, secondly, we support 9 winter sports teams. There's snow sports, there's skating sports, and there's sliding sports. And then the third thing we do is we provide scholarships to athletes in financial need. Because these sports are so expensive, we have the Stein Erickson YSA Opportunity Endowment, $2 million campaign that we finished last year to help support these kids financially.
And Hatch, I mean, what have you seen in terms of results from Team Park City United in terms of how YSA has, you know, helped?
Oh, it's made an enormous difference, and you know we're seeing athletes, you know, that have had the opportunity to be scholarshiped and come up through these programs that are out there. You know, we just had the Rev Tour, which is our first event. We had two kids on the podium every day, one male, one female. So we're off to a good start, and some of those athletes look like they're going to be invited to the first of the qualification series for the Olympic Games, which will be happening the beginning of the month. So it's pretty darn exciting to see what's coming out of this town.
Yeah. And for you, Sam, I don't even know if you were born during the 2002 Olympics at that point, but
yeah, I didn't live here at the time, but it's really exciting to see what it's left behind. The facilities we have are amazing from it, especially the ski jumps. It's so cool to be able to jump summer and winter. They're very helpful.
And you certainly have kind of made your way to where you are today through the YSA programs. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you just decided to go try ski jumping one day?
Yeah, in elementary school, I had just started learning to ski, and I'd done little jumps on the side of the runs, and it was really fun. So I joined the YSA program with ski jumping, and after a couple sessions with them, I was then funneled into the actual team, and they've been supporting me throughout. It's been very helpful.
All right. So you have been named to the U.S. national team. How did you go about doing that?
2 years ago, I competed in nationals, and I ended up getting second, so that was the gateway into it, and I made it again this year, but hopefully with my results from the end of this season, when they nominate the team again, I'll make the C team and actually get some more opportunities.
Yeah, you get just, what, more training, more money, more help?
Yeah, more, mostly invitations to compete on the international circuit.
All right. So in terms of the world championships that we've got coming up, are you competing in any of that?
I made the team, so there's 5 girls. And then when we have official training, depending on how I jump, they'll pick the top 4 to compete and represent the USA, and then we'll have an alternate. So we'll have to see how I jump at the first event.
Okay, when does that happen?
It starts January 30th, and it goes until February 6th, and I think the first competition is February 1st.
All right. So how far are you flying?
My furthest jump I've had is about 100 meters, but on the hill we have here, we're going to be mostly competing on our K90. So I've been going an average about 85 meters, but some girls will be approaching 100 meters well past the K point.
Okay. So you expect then to continue on, huh?
Yes, I hope to do well, and then in the summer, hopefully jump well at our nationals, and then maybe see you about 2018, the Olympics.
Okay. Well, we'll be rooting for you guys. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I just want to say how inspiring it is to see a kid that is given an opportunity to enjoy one of the sports that we have in this community and then to have a dream and able to support her. So it's really fun to watch.
Okay. Hatch, anything else?
Yeah, I just think, you know, we talk about the legacy, and right now we have from this community, just in the freestyle free skiing and snowboarding portion, 18 national team members, some of which are Olympic medalists already, Josh Christensen, Brian Wilson, that are out there vying. We've got Olympians that have come up through these programs already, and we've got a whole big flock of kids falling behind, and we have, you know, 10 athletes just on our team that aren't part of the national team that are in the hunt too. So there's this, and that goes across the board for the whole community. So it's pretty cool to see how hungry these kids are and how much fun it is just going after. This is the beginning of a long tour.
Okay, good luck, and especially to you, Sam.